Heart disease is the leading cause of death among most American women, but are women paying attention?
Women particularly are very good about getting good medical care when they're pregnant, and then they sort of get lost. We don't see them again until they have some complications due to hypertension, heart attack, stroke, kidney disease.
Plus, we're talking about the issue of hair bias when it comes to African Americans.
The frequent way that I experience hair bias is that people look at me and ask me to touch my hair. And then when they do touch my hair, they may make a comment like, oh, it's soft, or it's so nice.
But first, why is the NFL paying attention to laws in Springfield? We'll talk about why a proposal in the State House has attracted the attention of the NFL Players Association. And we hear from another business group, manufacturers, about what they would like to see happen with workers' comp laws in Illinois. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Right now, Illinois is the only state in the country where professional athletes who get injured can get workers' compensation payments until they're 67 years old. A bill in the state Senate is trying to change that. It's something that's being actively opposed by the NFL Players Association. Joining us now to explain what's going on is Xavier Pope. He's a sports, legal, and business analyst. He's the principal owner of 528 Media Group. He's online with us from Chicago. Hey, Xavier, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nana. How are you?
I'm good. So break this down for us. What do workers' compensation for pro athletes look like in Illinois right now?
Well, currently, athletes are in Illinois treated like other employees in Illinois. You receive benefits until you're 67. Most athletes, they receive some sort of benefit where you receive money based on your pre-existing before you were injured, and then you see the difference benefit to after you were injured. And this is what most employees receive in the state of Illinois. This is pretty much par for the course. This bill was changed in 2011, the Workers' Compensation Act of Illinois, where it reduced the age to 67 to kind of correspond with retirement age.
Okay.
And the issue right now is that this was signed on by major teams, the Cubs, Blackhawks, the White Sox, and the Bears, saying that most guys aren't playing until after they're 30. In the NFL, 3.5 years, NBA, 4.8 years, MLB, 5.6 years, and the NHL, 5.5 years. So guys are receiving benefits much longer than they normally would, and the bill is supposed to represent how long a certain employee would work in his lifetime, and that doesn't correspond necessarily with how long athletes play.
Sure, we're not seeing like 67-year-old professional athletes. So tell us, you were just mentioning a couple of the teams in the sports world. Who's for this and who's against it?
Well, a letter was signed on by all the major teams here in Chicago. So in support of this bill and who would be paying some of these benefits. The McCaskey family is strongly behind this as well. And so the Bears are definitely in support of this because they have the shorter term playing career of its players.
Right.
And the NFLPA, the National Football Players Association, is strongly against this. They sent a personal injury lawyer who's a lobbyist, Richard Gordon, to go speak before the Senate committee to discuss this. And he essentially said that, hey, this is not necessarily about big time athletes that are getting paid millions of dollars. This impacts mostly athletes that are making less than $100,000, like soccer players or their men and women soccer players, minor league baseball players and hockey players in the state of Illinois, and segregating these different athletes. Hey, they may not necessarily be.
Xavier, it looks
to get
like
certain opportunities to make money out of it.
Yeah. Sorry, Xavier, it looks like we lost you for a second there. Let me ask you, the NFL Players Association you mentioned has been very outspoken about this. I'm thinking about the Players Association president, DeMaurice Smith. He was on 670.
Yep.
He was on The Score talking about this, right? And he said if it passes, he's going to tell free agents not to sign with the Chicago Bears. I feel like I'm not going to make a joke right now about signing with the Bears and obstacles. But in all seriousness, Do you think that will happen? Like, do you think that if this bill passes, the Bears are going to have a problem signing players?
I think that you have to look at this from several pieces from this player standpoint. That player is looking at how much money they can make now in their career. They're not necessarily looking in terms of after they're finished playing. This is not a concern of many, especially younger players that are drafted who may move on to another team. This may, or a veteran who may look at playing for the Bears as their only opportunity to be able to make a roster and make money to take care of their family. So there's so many different factors that go toward a particular player playing for an individual team. It may impact maybe one player, two players, it could, but on the whole, I think that it doesn't represent each individual interest of any player that may sign to a contract with a professional football team.
Right. And so it also really, I guess, gets to this issue of the teams, the employer, and the employee, in this case, professional athletes.
Yeah, I think you have to look at it. There is a point that is made by some of the professional teams stating that the average career of a football player is 3.5 years. Well, that player has within 3.5 years to be able to make a decision as to what's going to be beneficial to him now in terms of making as much money as he can, to bank as much money as he can. A lot of players don't think they're invisible. They don't think that they're going to go out in terms of an injury. They don't. That's not how they're thinking. They're going to go away in a blaze of glory. They're going to retire. They're going to play forever. And so taking consideration, hey, I may get injured. I need to be able to play for a team and play in a state that's going to be able to get long-term benefits. Yes. But there's another part of this, Nyla, is Illinois has one of the most richest workers' compensation payment structures in the nation. And you know, the complaint is that there are guys who form shop, who decide to don't even play in the state of Illinois, who just because they played a game in Illinois try to take advantage of workers' compensation laws as well. So the issue is bigger than just, hey, guys that are playing in the state, who are playing for a team, or playing for the Bears, or playing for the Cubs, or Blackhawks, or the White Sox. These are other players that play games in the state of Illinois as well.
Yeah, that's a great point. Thanks for joining us. Sports, legal, and business analyst Xavier Pope on the line for us. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And that point that he made about Illinois and a workers' compensation is kind of what I want to move to now, because whether you're an athlete or working at a factory, getting injured on the job involves this issue. And we often hear from businesses in Illinois that point Xavier just made about the current laws in Illinois and how much they need to be changed. Joining me to talk about this now is Greg Bays. He's president of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. We've also got on the line with us State Senator Scott Bennett. He represents Illinois' 52nd district. Greg, Senator Bennett, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Greg, let's start with you. What are your thoughts on, you know, just hearing from Xavier about this bill? What are your thoughts on just how what he was just saying about workers' compensation in Illinois?
Well, what was interesting in the point that Illinois is one of the few states, not the only state, but very few states have worker comp coverage for their professional athletes. And so this sort of goes along the line that Illinois' work comp system is very generous, and indeed other players do attempt it. This is, I'm not trying to diminish the sports injury issue or to those players that are having this particular fight, but this issue is a much bigger issue and really than what the NFLPA is talking about. I assume that the leader of the Players Association would recommend that other players don't sign in states that don't have workers' comp system for their professional athletes. It's sort of a ludicrous argument. But let's get to the bigger point. The bigger point is about $3 billion a year is spent by folks on workers' compensation. That means the amount of medical expense that's paid for an injured worker, or the indemnity cost, meaning that if you have an injured back or you have lost a limb or an injury that you need to be compensated for has to be paid for in the workplace. And so that's the system we're really talking about. And Illinois does have a very high system, seventh highest in the nation, and it is the most often cited reason for manufacturers who make a decision to go elsewhere in the country to locate a facility or to expand that causes them to make that decision.
Let's go to Senator Bennett, Democrat, represents parts of Illinois, most of Champaign-Urbana's 52nd district. Senator Bennett, what are your thoughts on this? As you, not just as Greg's talking about, not just obviously for professional athletes, but for workers in general, how do you think the system stands now?
Well, certainly I'm sensitive to what Greg's trying to deal with. My district runs all the way to the Indiana state line. And so often we're looking, you know, how do we attract businesses into the state when perhaps costs might be lower in Indiana than they are in Illinois? So I'm sensitive to the things that Greg's trying to deal with. What we have to remember is that workers' compensation pays a percentage of the salary you were making before you're injured, particularly while you're injured. And so that's one thing that's important to remember. Illinois' rates are usually going to be higher because Illinois residents simply make more money. We're in the top 10 states in terms of wage earners. So the fact that an average Illinois resident makes about $10,000 more than the average Indiana resident, that's in part the reason that the rates are higher. There are certain things that can be tweaked, and perhaps the professional athletes are part of that. But I think the need to remember it is this 5 years ago, the Illinois legislature went in, drastically changed the Workers' Compensation Act, corrected many of the things that made it an outlier in other states. And what's happening now is insurance companies aren't paying out nearly what they were 6 years ago, but they're not passing those savings on to individual business owners. And that's something that I think needs to be discussed in any changes going forward.
Greg, what do you think when you're thinking about your members, manufacturers, to Scott's point about insurance companies passing on those benefits? Would you like to see that? What other changes would you like to see in Illinois' workers' compensation laws right now?
Well, I'm not here to defend insurance companies, and I think insurers must indeed pass along savings that are there. Illinois has a very competitive market. We have over 300 insurers that write workers' compensation plans. No insurer has more than 8% of the system. So if indeed there are savings to pass along, it will be passed along, and I assume that company would certainly gain more of the market share. But the point I think your listeners should understand about this is that why is it that Illinois, and part of that, and Senator Bennett's exactly right, is on wages and how that is handled. But the larger piece of that is the indemnity, or meaning that, let's say that you have lost an arm or the use of an arm. In Illinois, if you lose an arm and are compensated for that, the average cost is about $430,000. Now, there's no price you can really put on a limb, but indeed that is what happens in a comp case. The national average for that very same injury is $169,000. Now, I'm not even making the argument here that we should go to the national average. I think we should just become more in line, and it is part of the argument that we are making in the current discussions in Springfield, that the indemnity costs be lowered so that they're more in line with that. And I could go through each and every body part, so to speak, and you will see Illinois is just more generous than other states, and frankly, we need to be brought more in line. I'm not going to argue that we should be Indiana. Heck, I don't want to be Indiana, but I want Illinois to be competitive in being able to keep jobs here and not going across the border, as Senator Bennett knows happens all too often.
And to that point then, Greg, what your members are saying they would like to see is just, you're saying it the costs need to come down because it just needs to be more in line with neighboring states. Is that what Illinois manufacturers would like to see?
Well, I think everyone wants to talk about good middle-class jobs. That's a rallying cry for everybody. I was in a community in central Illinois a couple of weeks ago, economic development director talking about they were vying for a facility to remain in the community. They were looking at the state of North Carolina. The difference in the workers' compensation costs, if you move that facility to North Carolina, was going to be over $4 million a year. That's significant when companies are making a decision on where they're going to expand or locate. And I think that all of us in Springfield want to see injured workers taken care of expeditiously. They want to be taken care of appropriately, but we want to be competitive with our neighbors and being able to attract those good jobs.
Senator Bennett, when we're talking about this, as you know, as Greg has mentioned, the Senate is working on an attempt to break this, you know, 20-month-long budget impasse that we're in. How important do you see workers' compensation to everything in this sort of so-called grand bargain and all the different things, pieces that are in this?
So, you know, it's interesting with the grand bargain, as has been discussed, is actually about 13 different bills ranging from everything to from property tax to income tax to how we fund our schools. But of the 13 bills, I think the linchpin, what will decide whether this gets passed or not, will be whether we can reach some consensus on workers' compensation. Because I think the thing to remember, and you know, I certainly share Greg's interest in making sure that we're competitive with other states, but I also want to make sure that this isn't just a race to the bottom. And as he pointed out, we don't want to be Indiana. We don't want to treat our workers like that, because the typical workers' compensation case is not a professional athlete. It's, you know, a 40-year-old factory worker with a high school degree, and now he's lost his arm. How marketable is he in the future to do anything? And so when you talk about, well, $400,000 or $100,000, what's a good amount? You've got to remember that the system is just based to be – it's supposed to make sure that, you know, we don't have people starving when they are hurt when they're working for the benefit of their employer. And so it's trying to recognize that. Workers' compensation simply gives people medical care and a percentage of what they made until they get back on their feet. And in those instances where they're hurt so badly they can never work again, it gives them a lump sum to try to you know, get through the next 20 or 30 years or however long till they can retire. So that's what it's supposed to be doing. And I think we're all interested in addressing all things we can do to make sure that employers here in the state of Illinois are not paying much higher rates than other states. But we need to make sure that we're actually looking at all those things. We're not just hurting workers. We're also making sure that money gets returned to the employer when we're saving money through workers' compensation reform.
Just a yes or no question for me, Greg, because we're also out of time. Do you see workers' comp as the most important thing for Illinois manufacturers in this grand bargain?
That and getting our fiscal house in order.
Okay. Yes, yeah. Thanks for that. Greg Bays, president of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. Always a pleasure to have you on. Senator Scott Thank Bennett, you. A Democrat representing Illinois' 52nd district, Champaign-Urbana, as you were hearing him talk about this area. Senator Bennett, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last summer, Northwestern University pre-med student Annie Krall read an article about a 33-year-old woman who had a heart attack in the physical therapy office that Annie worked at. Luckily, the person Annie was reading about survived. But what stuck with her was the fact that woman was just 10 years older than her. Heart disease is the leading cause of death among most American women. On the line with us now, Annie is joining us from Evanston to talk about a workshop she's organizing this Saturday to help change that statistic. It's called Purple Goes Red, What Every Woman Needs to Know About Her Heart. We're also joined by Northwestern Medicine cardiologist Dr. Marla Mendelson, who helped Annie organize the event. Dr. Mendelson is director of the Women's Cardiovascular Health Program at Northwestern Memorial Hospital. Annie, Dr. Mendelson, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's exciting.
Annie, can you take me back to the day when you read that story? What was your first thought when you read about this young woman who had a heart attack?
First of all, it was confusion more than anything else. I wanted to think that there's no way this possibly happened to a woman who was 33, had no family history of cardiovascular disease, was in perfect shape, ate correctly, exercised, and all of a sudden had a heart attack. It was confusing, and then past the confusion, it just became scary that this was a possibility for anyone who has never thought before that this could, that a heart attack or a stroke or any kind of cardiovascular problem could happen to them. So that was the initial reaction for sure.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think what sort of inspired you then to go from reading that to having the idea of, I need to create an event so more women know about this?
I think the biggest problem was that I just never read about it before. I never heard about such a thing happening, especially amongst my peer group. And so there was this inspiration or motivation, let's call it, within me to bring an education source or a resource to women like me. I'm turning 20 in a week, which is 20 is the day when the American Heart Association suggests that you start getting your cholesterol checked. I find this out after I start doing my research. It was crazy to me to think that so many women don't know enough about their heart health. And that was sort of the inspiration behind what can I fix about this? What can I, as a Northwestern student who's also in a sorority and on a club sports and part of all these extracurricular activities, what can I do to try and raise awareness about cardiovascular health and how to prevent it and how to be prepared if and when something like a heart attack would happen to someone who doesn't expect it. So that was the motivation. And then, of course, I so kindly sent out an email to Dr. Mendelsohn, who just 100% was on board, and that was the greatest feeling in the world. Absolutely.
So, Dr. Mendelsohn, you're director of the Women's Cardiovascular Health Program at Northwestern Memorial Hospital. You also teach at Feinberg. You're associate professor of medicine and pediatrics. I imagine you're a pretty busy person, but when Annie contacted you, what did you think when you got that email?
Well, first of all, in this area, we're happy when people pay attention. Anybody pays attention, especially women, women of all ages, because for so long this has been an ignored issue. Women have assumed that they're not going to have a problem with their heart, and they certainly don't know about measures that they can take early in life that can impact on their future health and disease status. So it's refreshing when you hear somebody who's interested, a college student who's interested in it. And also, we had had a program recently through the American Heart Association and here at Northwestern trying to interest high school girls into basically the science, technology, engineering world. And we were involved with some of that, and we think this is extremely important. And getting a message out as early as possible is really the key thing, because health habits start really young. And there's so many things in college that sort of point in the other direction that it's a great time to kind of reset and get some good information, because there's a lot of bad information out there. And so that's the other thing, is whenever we have an opportunity to give good information, to bust the myths, to tell people, give them agendas to be proactive about their health, it's a great opportunity and we can't overlook it.
So thanks for that, Dr. Mendelsohn. Annie, what have you learned about some of the common myths? I know, Annie, you've been doing a lot of research on this now. As Dr. Mendelsohn saying, she wants to have good information out there. What's sort of some basic things you think women need to know about their heart health?
I think what's so empowering is the fact that, one, we're starting this education drive, but also to just raise awareness that women need to start taking control of their cardiovascular health. I think growing up, or at least in my teens, I never assumed that cardiovascular health would be a problem for a young woman like me, because without sounding too boastful, I'm physically fit, I'm active, I try and eat correctly as much as I can, and yet somehow there is this overarching possibility that cardiovascular problems could be in my future. So that's scary. And so I remember thinking, won't this just happen to older men who don't take care of themselves, who just drink beer all the time, who just eat incorrectly, all these things? And that's just not necessarily true anymore. I think what's so cool about it, though, is that you can, when I was starting to do my research, you can take action to try and prevent it. It's not all, okay, I have 4 people in my family who have had heart attacks and strokes, so I'm going to get one no matter what I do. That's not necessarily true. Yes, you're more prone to it, but at the end of the day, if you can take action to try and combat against your genetics, there's a much higher chance of you being not being affected by it later in life, which I think is just so inspiring. On top of that, I think what's so cool is that when I started to do my research into this and trying to come up with a workshop for women who are college age and who are also busy alums and all these other things, the people who we've reached out to, you don't need to have this drastic workout plan to try and get physically fit for your heart. You need 10 minutes, 15 minutes a day, every day, walking around. It's some small things that can make bigger impacts if you continue to keep up with them in a routine that are going to make a bigger difference later on in life, like Dr. Mendelsohn said. You need to start making the healthy choices now so that your body isn't so distraught by the time that you're older when bigger problems could come up and arise.
Dr. Mendelsohn, Andy's been talking a lot about prevention, which obviously is a very important piece of this. Healthy habits, exercise, which I think a lot of women have heard. What I wonder a lot of women haven't heard, Dr. Mendelsohn, is the way that if a woman were to suffer from a heart attack or cardiac arrest, women have different symptoms than men. Can you go through that? Because I think everyone's sort of heard, you know, I know there's a lot of cardiovascular disease in my family. And I know that sort of like, oh, if your left arm is hurting, that means maybe that might be something you should be worried about. That's not necessarily the case for women, right, Dr. Mendelsohn?
Well, there's a little bit confusing. When a woman is having a heart attack and she's having, there's a very high likelihood that she's going to present with chest pain. But not all chest pain is a heart attack, and there are other symptoms when you're having a heart attack. But just to take a step back, I think this workshop that we're doing is also important because the education to this point about people and their bodies is sorely lacking in general, okay? And we're talking about, you know, the Northwestern population. This is a, you know, a very motivated, educated population. But when we talk about heart attacks, there's lots of different things that can happen. The one heart attack is the arteries narrow, and there's decreased blood flow, and part of the heart muscle basically dies. There's also electrical events that can occur. There are a lot of different things, and they will all manifest with different symptoms. So as far as a heart attack per se, when there's decreased blood supply, yes, if somebody can get chest pain or even indigestion, and some of these atypical symptoms are maybe more common in women, we also believe that women may have a higher pain threshold, so they may be more likely to sort of blow it off as, you know, indigestion. But you have to look at the context. So what we tell people is that if you're having indigestion after eating something you shouldn't have been eating and then lying down, that's probably not your heart. If you have indigestion every time you climb up to your second floor apartment, that is something you need to worry about. So it's not only the symptoms, it's the context. And what also, there's a physiologic reason why we can't perceive the pain directly. So if you were, we had a pin and you stuck your finger, you'd know exactly where you were stuck because there's so many nerve endings in the tip of your finger. However, all the nerves from everything that goes on in the upper chest funnel to the brain through the same course. So that's what makes things difficult to sort out. So you can have lower jaw pain, you can have chest pain, chest tightness. When you walk into a patient's room and you say, "Are you having any chest pain?" and they go, "No." And they're sweating profusely, and you say, "Well, what's going on?" And they say, "Well, there's this elephant sitting on my chest." So some of it's the language and how we perceive pain. Down the left arm, again, because those nerves all enter the spinal cord at the same place. So it can be difficult, but you have to take it in context. Now, when you take somebody who is living the perfect life, has no risk factors, you know, unfortunately, lightning can happen. There have been reports of, particularly in women and often in pregnant women, where the artery just tears. The artery wall just tears for some reason and clot forms and there's decreased blood flow. But these people, all the ones that I have known, have usually presented with chest pain. Mm-hmm. Now, when a 26-year-old walks into the emergency room with chest pain, they're not going to be thinking about cardiac disease, but I think it's incumbent upon healthcare providers to actually, you know, broaden their scope a little bit and take this under consideration, because it is a problem. And it isn't that the problem is increasing, it's that we are starting to recognize it more. So we're seeing that there are more events in younger women. We always thought that women were protected because of the naturally occurring estrogen in their bodies until they go through menopause. And that may be generally true, except for certain women, women with polycystic ovary syndrome, or the woman with diabetes. And that also is the woman who's not going to have typical symptoms because she may have problems with her nerve sensations.
Yeah. So that's, and it's interesting because I know Annie Shayna, who was in the article that you, Shayna's a woman who was the, that you read about. She had symptoms like dizziness and fainting that she didn't suspect because of her age, because she was 30. Dr. Mendelsohn, I guess it sounds like you're saying there's just a lot that goes into this that everyone just needs to be, think about being just, Dr. Mendelsohn, it sounds like you're saying people just also need to just be paying a lot more attention to their bodies and be more aware of this.
Well put. That is absolutely true. And I think that any way we can raise awareness for that issue so that people are more cognizant of what's going on, if they maintain a good level of fitness and all of a sudden they hit a wall, that's something that needs to be looked into. For somebody who is experiencing dizziness and, you know, they try the usual things like fluids and regular meals and all of those things, and they maybe go see their doctor, their blood sugar is fine. But if it's occurring and there's palpitations, you have to worry about an electrical event, because even if your arteries are crystal clear, you're still at risk for electrical events.
And Dr. Mendelsohn, yeah, can I ask you about, because I know there's also been research about women and healthcare professionals and women, the fact that healthcare professionals may often overlook cardiovascular disease as a diagnosis for women. Do you think that's changing?
Oh, I do. I think it is changing. It was there were a couple studies published back in the 90s that really brought this to light. And I think since then, that has launched several initiatives at the National Institutes of Health, at the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, with the American Heart Association, to raise awareness. But this awareness campaign, like the Go Red campaign, the Red Dress campaign, it's not just for women, it's for the physicians too. And the physicians, the emergency room doctors, the other healthcare providers, so that they are cognizant of it. But we still have a long way to go. That's why I was so excited when Annie contacted me and reached out, because I love to talk about this issue to anybody who will listen, because I think it's really important to get the message across. Women particularly are very good about getting good medical care when they're pregnant, and then they sort of get lost. And we see that with high blood pressure. Women who have high blood pressure during pregnancy, they could get high blood pressure later in life. And they need to know that, because usually what happens is they get so busy with their families and taking care of everybody else's health that we don't see them again until they have some complications due to hypertension, heart attack, stroke, kidney disease. So it's so important any way we can in any platform to get this message out there.
And so, Dr. Mendelsohn, you were talking about the Go Red, Wear Red campaign. Annie, for your Purple Goes Red event on Saturday, what kind of prevention tips are you going to be sharing with people?
I think what's so cool about it is, well, first of all, Dr. Mendelsohn was the one who came up with the name, because we couldn't figure out a title to come up with something that was so catchy. So Purple Goes Red was the one we decided on. And what every woman needs to know about her heart is pretty encompassing about what the seminar is going to be. We're going to touch on, first of all, my part is going to be, here's what I thought about what heart health meant and why I didn't know nearly half as much as I needed to know about my heart, and here's what I want everyone else in the audience to know about. So that's going to be the first portion of it. It's this myth-busting, true facts about cardiovascular health. The second portion is going to be about everything that you said, Nyla, about how you have to eat correctly and exercise and everything that we've heard so many times over, but more in the perspective of why is this going to help your heart, rather than this is just something that I want to do so that I can have my spring break body and all these other things that college students are so worried about. It's more of an effect of this is something that I want to do for my lifestyle rather than something that I need to do right now. So that, I think, is what I hope everyone takes away from the workshop, is that it doesn't just start on this Saturday afternoon in this really pretty room with a cardiologist standing there and smiling at you. It's something that we all need to take up on our own and can do with the correct tools at our disposal. So something that we're going to do is a workout in the middle of the workshop so that women can see, okay, here's a 10, 15-minute workout that I can do on my own every day whenever I have time. And that, I think, is something that I hope everyone can walk away with and say, okay, I know how to do this. I can take control. I can prevent cardiovascular health because I've been armed with these resources and with these facts.
That sounds great. That's the event. It's this Saturday at the Norris Student Center, if you're on campus in the Evanston area, at 2 o'clock, organized by Annie Krall and a pre-med student at Northwestern University. I want to thank Annie and Dr. Marla Mendelsohn, director of the Women's Cardiovascular Health Program at Northwestern Memorial Hospital, also teaches in the Feinberg School of Medicine. Dr. Mendelsohn, Annie, thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Dyla.
I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. A new study finds that there's still bias against Black women who wear their hair naturally. It came from the Perception Institute. That's a consortium of researchers, advocates, and strategists, and showed that the bias is from a majority of people, regardless of their race or their gender. But it also showed that the bias against natural hair is in learned behavior, providing hope that it can also be unlearned. Joining us now to talk about all of this on the line from Chicago, Patrice Yersic is the creator of Afrobella. It's a natural hair, beauty, fashion, and makeup blog. She's also often called the godmother of brown beauty blogging. Hey, Patrice, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, I think we've all heard stories of Black women being asked by their boss to cut their dreadlocks or trim their afros. There was even a court case about this, and I'm going to get to it in a minute. Is that what we mean when we say hair bias?
Well, I think that there is that kind of overt hair bias that can result in unfortunate workplace circumstances. But then there's also everyday bias and assumption where you look at somebody and you think you know what their job is based on what their hair looks like, or you think that they know what their proclivities might be based on their hair. My friends with locks speak about this frequently, where people may assume that you consume marijuana based on the way that you wear your hair, or people may assume that you are, let's say, you know, a very politically outspoken person based on your hair. So, I mean, one example of hair bias that I can give that is not necessarily something that would have affected me in the workplace is once I walked into a store and the woman assumed that I was in a Broadway play because the play happened to be visiting town and here's this person with this hair. So she looked at me and saw performance.
She thought it was
in
a
my
costume.
Appearance.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know what I mean? And it's just this kind of assumption that comes from not knowing somebody or not really knowing what it would be like to have that hair texture.
And so that's sort of the overt things, Patrice. I wanted to ask you how often, and you were, that's particularly, we've been talking about a workplace or overt things. How often do maybe less, maybe sort of maybe not as open things like saying, you know, oh, I think you're assuming something about someone. How often does other things happen to you? I know like people touching your hair, asking you if they can touch your hair.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that happens to me frequently. And I mean, I think, by nature of who I am and by nature of what I do, I kind of represent an ambassadorship for natural hair. So I welcome the discussion. But not everybody, you know, who wears their hair this way is welcoming that discussion or is inviting people to touch or discover what a unique hair texture is like. I would say it happens at this point. It depends on how often I leave the house. But it happens definitely on a weekly basis where people might stare at me or come up to me and ask me a hair question. And that this can be a Black person or a white person or any kind of person. But, you know, it does happen when I'm out frequently.
Mm-hmm. And obviously this is your job. This is your industry, is to be talking about this.
Exactly.
And writing about it. I wonder, how did you personally get to the point where you decided you weren't going to change anything about your hair?
So that really came about, I would say, I decided to go natural in the year 2002, and that was, you know, the process of deciding not to use chemicals to alter my hair texture at that point. And once I figured out what my hair needed within, I would say, the next 2 or 3 years, I realized that this was just what, it felt right. It felt as the natural, I guess, is the word I'm dancing around here. It really felt just like this is an expression of who I am. This is what I'm meant to look like. And I can experiment within these parameters, but this is how I'm most comfortable wearing myself and being myself in the world. So, you know, it takes everybody a certain amount of time, or sometimes you figure it out on your own terms and try things that are different. But for me, this has been my path. I'll experiment with color, but this is my hair texture and this is how I choose to wear it.
Let's talk about the study for a minute, Patrice. The study had people look at images and associated words based on the pictures that they saw. And then they found that this bias existed regardless of race or gender?
Yes. Yes, it appears that this, you know, it came across that mostly, it seems interesting to me that white women express a higher
the strongest bias. Actually.
Yeah, towards black women hair. And what was least surprising to me is that millennial, you know, women with natural hair are the ones who have the most positive attitudes. And but you can see that there's still bias within the black community. It really is, it's something that's across the board, but I think it's primarily women who think so much about hair, and we expect that, you know, we have certain expectations of appearance that we have to work on and we have to ask ourselves questions about.
Well, and I think all women do, right? And I think in particular, this
exactly.
study found that white women express the strongest bias, but it also mm-hmm. found that white women who had contact with black women demonstrated much lower levels of bias.
Right, exactly.
So what does that say to you?
It says to me that if you're around people and you're able to have a shared experience and see that we're not that different, I think if you're a person who's got a limited, I don't want to say a limited life experience, but limited exposure to people who are different from you, it's easy to draw conclusions based on what you see, maybe on television or on you know, different forms of media, advertising, through magazines, that kind of thing. And the way that we consume media is increasingly segregated. So we're really just kind of preaching to our own choirs and not discovering what is, you know, different about each other, but also what is same about each other. So we might have similar hair issues, but you might look at me and assume, well, her texture looks like this. It must be so extremely different from mine. And without doing the education or knowing somebody who, you know, truly is living this life, it's easy to have this kind of assumption. I've had people ask me if I wash my hair. Why would you ask me that? Of course I'm, you know, a person who is clean, who is going about her life, why would you assume that? It comes from an ignorance based on appearance, based on never interacting with somebody who looks like me.
And
right,
and I think it's so interesting when you say that, Patrice, because I think hair is such a personal thing, right? And I'm thinking about, mm-hmm. you know, I'm Indian. People always comment on my Indian hair. Like, that's kind of a thing that people also always talk about.
Right.
But I wonder, when you're thinking about how we... when we think about segregation and how we self-segregate, and I even think, I'm curious your thoughts about, as someone who, your whole industry is brown beauty, what kind of advice do you have for people who maybe are outside of that for how to do a better job with maybe knowing more about it?
I think, what do you want to know about it is the question, I think. And also, why do you approach somebody with this lens of curiosity or lens of assumption that you can then perhaps pet them or touch them? I think it's just a matter of observation and a matter of self-education. If I have a question about something, I go to Google instead of maybe asking somebody a question that may come across as insensitive or inadvertently offensive. So I think, you know, there's a lot of personal responsibility and self-education that can be done. I don't know. I think more and more I'm seeing representation of women like myself in the media. I'm seeing ads where there are women with locks, there are women with curly hair, there's women with short natural hair, long natural hair. And the more that there is this representation in the media, is the more that there's going to be an understanding that, you know, the old standards of beauty are no longer as applicable as they were.
And I wonder how important you think it is that, and I'm thinking particular pop culture, I'm thinking about TV, I'm thinking about shows like Black-ish and different stars who have worn their hair in different ways. So how important is it just to sort of, I think, have popular culture or media representations that are maybe, I don't know if mainstream is the word, but just sort of just how important is it for no matter what color you are to see people who look like that?
It's major. It's a game changer. Everybody wants to be seen. Everybody wants to see a reflection of themselves. And this is what led me to start Afrobella back in 2006. You know, I just read about a little boy who loves Lester Holt and loves seeing him on NBC because he's brown like me. You know, it's this affirmation that you are a person who can be in different spaces. And I think that's part of the natural hair thing. Seeing natural hair as professional, we need to see more natural hair professionals out there in the world to understand that it's not something that is limited to a person who's in a creative space or a person who's a student or whatever the assumptions about natural hair might be on that particular day.
Right. There's that famous picture. I'm thinking of the little boy with President Obama saying, hey, yeah, your hair's like mine. But I mean, I wonder, Patrisa, when you say that about sort of seeing this as a professional thing, if you can, I mean, there, this study also sort of talked about sort of the anxiety that women, all women have anxiety or think about their hair. But I wonder in particular the pressure that you think Black women, women of color have when they're thinking about their hair being natural or curly. How much of there is a, is there a bias against that? Even when there are court cases, right? The EEOC lost a case last year against saying this one employment offer that was rescinded for a woman saying she could not have dreadlocks. And they, the courts ruled that wasn't considered racial discrimination. The EEOC lost that case.
That's crazy. I mean, I just recently heard about something like this, and I don't believe it went to the EEOC, but a woman with dreadlocks had been growing her locks for a very long time, and she worked in the healthcare industry. They told her she had to cut her hair. And it doesn't matter if to them if it's clean, if it's an expression of your culture. It comes from ignorance. It comes from a lack of understanding. And I think that it makes sense that Black women would experience high levels of anxiety about hair, especially since this very study is revealing that there is explicit bias towards Black women with textured hair. So if you're going into an interview situation or job situation, you would be anxious, you would be concerned, you don't know how you might be received. And I do know many women who make the decision to alter their appearance based on a job interview. And then they're like, okay, later I can be myself. Let's unpack that statement and think about what that tells people and what that means. You know, it's unfortunate that in 2017 we're still kind of policing each other's appearance based on what your natural hair texture is, without understanding that this is something that we just are. So I'm hoping that it continues to change. The more visibility there is, the more celebration there is, the more that we see women like this on TV in different roles. You mentioned Black-ish. I love Black-ish. You know, I mean, every female character on that show wears natural hair and rainbows, a doctor doing her thing. You know, it's beautiful and it's inspiring. And that's what younger generations will see and realize that they can occupy these spaces too.
Patrisa, in spite of what this conversation we're having, the facts are that natural hair is becoming more popular. We're thinking about, you made another interesting point about millennials. It sounds like you feel like things really are changing.
I think that, I mean, I can definitely say this year is 11 years I've been blogging, I've seen a lot of progress. I think we have a lot further to go, but I think that now with social media and with the internet, we're able to kind of take the reins back from mainstream media, and we're able to say, to affirm our beauty and to speak out against discrimination and injustice in a way that we weren't able to directly before. So via Twitter, if you see something on TV that's saying something negative about natural hair, back in the day, you might have had to write an angry letter about it or a blog post. And now you can directly address that to the producers of the show, to the people who made the decisions to say whatever they did. So, you know, there's accountability now in a way that there wasn't in the past. So I think it's only going to get better from here.
That's Patrisa Yersek. She's a beauty, hair, and culture writer. You can find her at Afrobella on Twitter. You can find her at her blog as well, where she's got everything about brown beauty on her site, on all of her social media handles. Hey, Patrisa, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That does it for us today. Tomorrow, Chaz Eber joins us to talk about the Oscars. They're coming up on Sunday. We're going to talk about all of the picks for Best Picture. By the way, if you want to tell us what your favorite picture is, tweet us. Our handle is 21st Show. That's 21ST Show. If you follow us on Twitter, we live tweet during the show with more analysis and background on what we're talking about. We just tweet out that study we were talking about as well. When we're not on the air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. On our Facebook page, search for the 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on. You can post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. If you want to give us other feedback, leave us a voicemail, send us an email, find all of those links. All of that's at our website. That's 21stshow.org. We're produced by Howlett DeLahi, Christine Herman, and Alan Montesilio. Abrar Elhiti is our intern. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. And Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.